It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for February 5th, 2022. It's been a really weird week. I have guests lined up for the next couple of weeks, but whether it's due to the inclement weather, crazy schedules, or just an I've had enough feeling, no new guests this week. So I thought I'd offer up a few news stories that have been buzzing around the bike world this week, along with the encore presentation of an interview with the one and only Tom Ritchie. Recorded back in February of 2019, we had a splendid conversation. So first up, the word game that is sweeping the internet, Wordle. If you're a word nerd like I am, you've probably already tried it. But when I was growing up, we played a game called Jotto. Exact same premise. Come up with a five-letter word, put it at the top of your page, fold down the paper so your opponent can't see it, print the alphabet at the bottom of your paper, and start guessing your opponent's word. There was no limit to the number of tries in Jotto, which is a bit different from Wordle since your opponent happens to be the internet. Now, the hottest thing since index shifting, and for bike nerds, there's Bikel. Really? Yes, the premise. Find the surname of a cyclist that has five letters. You want to play? Type in B-I-K-L-E on a browser. Not sure how many five-letter surnames there are of past and present pros, but what the hell? It's one word a day, and you'll get six tries to figure it out. Probably the most talked about story this week is what Specialized has decided to do. Sell direct to the consumer. Bypassing the usual bike shop experience, and by extension, bypassing the bike shop's expertise, in my opinion. Apparently eating his own words from 10 years ago in a statement that went something like, "We will never sell bikes over the internet," Mike Sinyard, founder and CEO of Specialized, has done an about-face. From letting dealers know to stories in every cycling publication, the announcement that Specialized will have a white-glove delivery option right to your door with a fully assembled bike is just the newest in a series of big changes in the bicycle world. As you can imagine, dealers' responses range from expletives to realizing they will just have to deal with it. You can read the options the company is offering in a piece in Bicycle Retailer from January 27th. The new delivery options went into effect February 1st. Another story that caught my attention is about America and Britain's Got Talent host and star Simon Cowell. Seems he might need training wheels as he was rushed to the hospital for a second crash on his e-bike in 18 months. His first crash was in Malibu and resulted in a myriad of injuries, including breaking vertebrae in his back. This one was in the UK, and he's now sporting a cast on one arm. The second crash was a header on slippery pavement, and apparently he's even considering wearing a helmet in the future. For those who have been around a long time, you may remember an apparel company by the name of Kucharik. Fabricating really fine wool cycling apparel since 1980, founder John Kucharik passed away in 2008 at the age of 93. He never wavered from his commitment to the natural fabrics. His son, John Jr., kept the company operating, but has decided to close the business, saying, quote, "I'm going to turn 69 pretty soon. It's really sad because I have a lot of customers, but I've been promising my wife to travel and to do some stuff." Another piece of the bicycle industry goes down in the history books. And if you are waxing nostalgic on that story, the incomparable Sheldon Brown was remembered this week. He passed away on February 4th, 2018. Brian and I met him at one of the trade shows a couple of years before he died. He was a fascinating guy with a crazy smart brain. His site lives on with all of its amazing content because of his wife, Dr. Harriet Fell, and bicycle aficionado John Allen. If you want to see what Sheldon had up his sleeve, sheldonbrown.com. Lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention Egan Bernal. The talented young pro crashed into the back of a bus on a training ride, ending up in the ICU and eventually having several surgeries to put him back together. On February 3rd, he stated that he, quote, almost died, but I'm back, as he revealed the outrageous injury list describing his last surgery as the most difficult race of his life. He seems to be thinking he'll be back, though, so we're sending him healing vibes for sure. So let's take a short break, and then it's our encore presentation of my interview with Tom Ritchie. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Tom Ritchie has always said he owes a lot to his father, from teaching him to repair tubular tires to brazing a broken frame. Tom learned it all from his dad, and did he ever learn? Probably one of the most prolific idea men in our sport, Tom is credited with firsts dating back to 1974, with his twin-plated crown forks and rolling into frames, tubing, bottom brackets, forks, and so many other things. The following is the conversation Tom and I had back in February of 2019. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, Tom Ritchie. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
My pleasure. I'm glad to join you.
Yeah, so I don't think anyone who listens to my show does not know who you are. So we're going to dispense with some of the preliminaries and get to it. Let's start with where you grew up. You did not grow up in California.
Well, not in an absolute sense, but my beginnings were all on the East Coast. My dad was a new engineer on the GI Bill, graduated from Penn State, had an opportunity to work at a company called RCA.
I remember that.
Yeah, most people probably don't even know what RCA stands for. Anyway, he was an electrical engineer with a specialty in radio. And I ended up with my sister and my mom being given a chance. Well, actually, my dad took a job for another company that most people don't know the name of, which was one of the beginning Silicon Valley companies called Ampex.
Didn't Ampex have something to do with recording tape?
Yeah, they were the pioneer in recording disc technology. They competed with Hewlett-Packard. They were the first that created stop frame technology for the 68 or 64 Olympics, when you started to see photo finishes.
Right.
And things like that. That was Ampex technology. It was basically, they made oscilloscopes, which they were less known for, which was a direct competitor with Hewlett and Packard.
Interesting. Like long time ago stuff from when I was growing up. So I think you're exactly 10 years younger than me.
It's 1956.
And I was born in 46. So yes, I do know that. Yeah. Anyway, I watched recently, my husband and I watched a video of you speaking with a group in, I think it was in Germany, and it was really fascinating. And what I got out of it, the first thing was, what a thinker you are. You know, that you really think about things like an engineer. Of course, I'm married to an engineer, so I know how he thinks, sort of. And so have you always been that kind of a thinker and then able to put those thoughts into action?
Well, I'm not sure I'm a thinker in terms of, you know, Thoreau and people like, you know, the academic side of things. But I would say that, you know, from people that make things and figure things out and all that kind of stuff, I would definitely say, why not, when it comes to figuring something out. And I grew up with a surrounding amount of engineers. My dad was not just an engineer. He was for the most part, a renaissance man in terms of making things. And underneath the tree, when I was 11 years old, he designed a two-person kayak that was about I think 20 feet long, and put all the materials and stuff under the tree, and design the boat and the bulkheads and the mat and the plans and everything. And anyway, he'd never done anything like that, but you know, that was him. And I just inherited an idea that people do things from scratch or ground up and kind of look at something and reinvent or create. And that was just a normal thing for his generation. And it became normal to me at a very young age.
But you had the capability. So I can see growing up with, like, my dad couldn't put a hammer and a nail together. So I, you know, totally different. And yet I have some sort of technical ability, you know, working in a bike shop for 40 years didn't hurt, but I can see you actually followed that route. So I've always found that really, really interesting. Most of us, I think of you as part of that early mountain bike group. But when I was talking to Brian this morning, he was telling me that you actually lived on the other side of the mountain from some of these mountain bike people like Charlie Kelly and Gary Fisher. Is that true?
Yeah, most people who know the Bay Area know that there's a Marin County side across the Golden Gate, and there's a peninsula side, which is on the San Francisco side. And I lived on the peninsula side, the San Francisco side. I grew up in Palo Alto. Hmm. My backyard was the Santa Cruz Mountains and Stanford and all the adjacent areas. It's probably, as far as a land mass, about 5 or 10 times the size of Marin. So it, in terms of a backyard, it was a big, big backyard.
Yeah, right.
And without a lot of people, it was a wonderful place.
So how did you hook up with these guys and get into this quote-unquote new thing, mountain biking?
Well, people don't understand kind of the NorCal scene back then, but bicycle racing was considered, I don't know, most people probably understand how Boulder was very important in the 80s and 90s for people that were on the Motorola 711 team, and they kind of assembled there and created, you know, some of the best racing training environments with the Rockies in their backyard. Well, Northern Cal was the same way. So my dad became a cyclist way before me. And that was, you know, in the 60s, where cycling and touring was kind of a novel thing. He was into novel things. He was a member of the Sierra Club. So, you know, backpacking the Muir Trail and Yosemite and all these places was what he was. Let me just tell you a little bit more about my dad. He left the East Coast in 1963, and he got to California with huge opportunities right before him in a ultimate nature experience. He first stopped smoking. That was when the Surgeon General came out and said it was harmful, and he looked around and said, I'm just going to stop that.
Good man.
Joined the Sierra Club. Got involved with a bunch of friends at work that were into sailboat racing, built his own sailboat in the garage, and became NorCal champion of that category of racing. Was a cyclist in terms of riding to work, but then just kept running into people going longer and longer distances. And by the time that I was kind of catching up with him in seventh grade and kind of wanting to follow him around everywhere, found myself basically doing a lot of the same stuff and enjoying every minute of it and kind of having a great experience, just discovering California in a big way. Led to a friend of mine that was in seventh grade, Donnie McBride, being on a ride out in the Santa Cruz Mountains and, you know, well away from home, and running into a bunch of guys that were serious cyclists. And we kept up with them, and they said, hey, why don't you come to our club meeting? And at 14 years old, I joined the Belmont Bike Club and started racing, started as an intermediate, 14 years old, realized that I was enjoying it, and started, you know, this was 1971, 70 and 71, I think I raced my first race in 70, actually, at the Atascadero Bicycle Rally on a hill climb, got second to a junior that was the state champion at that time, and didn't think really much of it, but it wasn't until we ran into the local guys that were racers that it became much more serious to me, and at that point, I was immediately looking for a better bike, and I resulted in finding a $50 used Chinelli that was broken. And at 14 years old, I asked my dad, "Hey, Dad, would you help me repair this?" And it required taking, learning how to use an oxyacetylene torch, taking out a seat stay in the bike and replacing it with another seat stay, and getting a bike that I could race. And that was that.
Wow.
Beginning period.
Yeah. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Tom Ritchie, the iconic Tom Ritchie. Yes, that one. Interesting. So 14, you're already picking up a torch. Very cool. Very cool.
And I was doing it before then, but this was a little more on the serious side.
Yeah, right.
So I'd built an electric car from thin wall tubing, and with my dad, much more with my dad's help in that, but it was all in that time period. My dad wouldn't let me have a go-kart. So I was a kid. I was looking to go fast. I was looking to do these kind of things. And so I can send you a picture of the go-kart. It's still a pretty cool picture.
We can put it up on the blog. I would love that. And I'll bet it's a cool picture. I'll bet it's cool.
Yeah.
So besides your dad, who else was really influential to you as you became more immersed in cycling, and not necessarily the racing culture, just cycling in general?
Well, it would have to be Joop Brandt. And my dad, when I was just kind of at that point, my dad was more and more serious about doing big rides, you know, centuries and things like that, that were starting to become popular. And one Sunday he got back from a ride all muddy, and he was just like beaming and just ecstatic and excited. And I said, "Dad, what did you do?" He goes, I just met this guy and went on a ride, and we just went all over the place, and off road, on road. It was amazing. And he, you know, just was so totally excited that I ended up wanting to, of course, explore who this was. And I ended up, I think it was the next Sunday or whatever, going on what was called a Joop's ride. And everyone knew what that meant. And it was from his house on Embarcadero Street in Palo Alto. And, you know, he took off and went on road, off road, did all these great rides out in the Santa Cruz Mountains all day long, and you come back at like 4 or 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and you're totally exhausted, and you're repairing your bike because all kinds of things happened.
Yeah, which would be my next question. What was he riding, and then what were you riding, and what did that lead to?
Well, okay, so basically you have to understand that the way in which cycling had developed in the United States was of course very different than Europe and other places, and it was basically pretty lock, stock, and barrel a European driven sport. And so there was maybe one custom builder that I had heard about, and that was a builder called Paragon. But that was in the 60s and 70s. Eisentraut was just getting started. I don't think he had built previous to that time, but I think it was just probably about that time in 1970, 71. I could be wrong on that. So everything that everyone was riding was European. So Joop's rode a Chinelli. I rode a Chinelli. my dad rode a bike called a Viking, which was an English bike.
Yeah, I remember the Viking.
Ron Cooper, Mozzie. There was pretty much, essentially Campanello equipped, some other oddball lower cost products like universal brakes and other things that people save some money on. But most people have the drivetrain Campy and if they could afford that. And so that was what Yopes rode, what I rode. And, you know, it was a great thing at the moment, at the time. It was pretty much 10 speeds, maybe 12, depending upon some upgrades and some things that people were doing. And that was pretty much the way that it was in 1972. Maybe one or two pro shops that would be, maybe three. Actually, there was VeloSport, I think, that was right about then. Spence Wolf was at Cupertino Bike Shop, was well before then in the 60s. But the idea of importing European, high quality European bikes was a novel thing.
Yeah. So you actually made a bike. You made a frame.
Well, I think the best part way to tell the story is that having repaired a bike, I had other people knowing that had broken bikes. Everyone was riding something that was used for the most part. Very few people had new bikes. And, you know, even though steel is a wonderful material, at some point something's going to happen. You're going to buckle the front end. You're going to do something. You're going to need a new down tube. You're going to need a new, you know, seat stay, chain stay, something. And I started, people started knocking on my door asking. I was all about the commercial side. If I could not do typical things like mow lawns and babysit and things like that, I was really happy. And so I was happy to build wheels and repair tubulars and kind of have a my own little bike shop business out of the garage, including repairing frames. And so I probably repaired about 10 frames, realized that what I was seeing inside the frame was a lot rougher and cruder and poorly built and put together than I expected, and thought to myself, if this is what's inside these frames, I should be able to do the same or better. And so that was the beginning idea of building my first frame when I was 15, and ended up having my own design and very cheap, steep, short wheelbase kind of Criterion bike, and being able to do well on it and win races and stuff just kind of put the spotlight on some things that were different about my approach to things. And then came other orders, and that was off I went.
Off you went. No kidding. So you did do some what I would consider innovative, revolutionary things that today would seem probably old fashioned. But for example, I know that your bars and your stems are on all our bikes. I mean, certainly on our tandem, on my husband's singles, and they're your designs. What do you think about all these changes that are coming now, like these oversized head tubes and these press fit bottom brackets and these new dropout designs? Is it for the sake of change, or do you see a real reason to have this kind of sort of explosion of different sort of standards? There are no standards. The standards are gone.
It's a very complicated thing to unpackage in a single question like that. You know, the experimentation was what, I mean, I just have to preface this kind of a question with, I was my own guinea pig, and I showed up at Yope's house with something new, and he chastised me, and he was a German engineer and came from that tradition, 20 years older than me, had, you know, all kinds of respect for the history of of cycling and the masters and people who made stuff that worked. And I would listen to him, but at 16 years old, I thought to myself, this is not that hard. This is something that I'm going to figure out and make some changes. And so I had both. I was in an amazing time of living when very few people were playing with experimenting. And I also had a mentor that was incredibly hard and harsh on me. I mean, his voice echoes and reverberates inside my brain, even though he's been passed away for a number of years. So he was always quick to remind me of things that were engineering based and history based and standards based and the value of those things. And I got lectured in an incredible way. And you can talk to other people that knew Yost, and it's not a singular story for me and me alone. He did it to everybody.
Sure.
And I went back for more. So for me, it was part of kind of how I developed in my experimenting. And an interesting anecdote to that is at a time in my career when I was transitioning from road to building mountain bikes. I remember building Eric Heiden a couple of road bikes in 1980. And when he was coming on the scene, and my road bike was what he won the Core State Pro Championship on. And Bicycling Magazine wanted to talk to me, do a review. And I remember them looking at the bike. It had a steel stem on it that I made for Eric. It was filled with braze. It was lugless. It was, completely different than anything else that was being built at the time. And here was, Mr. Huge Leg Sprinter, strong Eric Heiden racing one of my bikes. And so it was interesting to them. And I'd never been approached by Bicycling Magazine until then. And I remember in the interview, the question was, if we did an article about this, would you even be able to make enough bikes? It was like a question based on, it would be irresponsible to do too big of an article on this because you couldn't supply.
Interesting. What'd you tell them?
I forget, but I know they did an article. I know it was small and all, but I think the main thing is that there was a different mindset amongst the publications. So what we think of now in our immediate response media culture, where anything and everything that someone experiments with gets presented as responsible or something that's out there that you can buy, and regardless of whether it's been done before, or whether it's been proven or tested or raced on or whatever it is, it's available. That's the mindset of the media now. And the media is here and there and everywhere. But the media back then, Bicycling Magazine was, the number one magazine at the time, and probably still is, as far as I don't pay attention to subscription rates or things like that right now. But the idea that it would be irresponsible in terms of the people that were advertising in their magazine, the Schwinns and the Panasonics and the other companies that were in the magazine, and of course the component companies and primarily, Campion, things like that, it would be irresponsible to the public, to the consumer, to promote somebody that would probably not be around tomorrow or was new or novel in terms of their approach to things or in design or whatever. And even though Eric Heiden had just won the Core State Pro Championship, there was just a reservation. There was a holding back. I could tell in the questioning from the guy, I think it was John Schubert, that was interviewing me. And I'm just pointing that out, just in a contextual way, because the the way in which we react to things, or the person that's new into the sport or thinking about a purchase or thinking about what to do with, you know, the choices that are out there. There are so many, and there's such little historical context. When you talked about bottom brackets and headsets and things like that, there's just little historical context to them being novel or new. If you looked at my bike from 19, my first mountain bikes, and if you look at my bike from 1974, it had sealed bottom bracket, it had a pressed in sealed bottom bracket. If you looked at Bianchi Nuevo record from the 60s, it had drop in bearings. These things aren't new. There's reasons why they became adopted and put into place and part of what we're now considered to be standards, but they're not new. They were experimented with. People innovated. They thought of these things. They created them. They lived, they died, and they got rebirth. And there's a lot more of that than people would ever understand. And you have to live 45 years doing the same thing that I've been doing to know that, and to know the mind of the cyclist and the racer and the people like Cinelli and Campanello and some of the original true innovators of component design, frame design, that were trying to solve a problem way back a long time ago. And probably the simplest way that people can understand this is that there was a Formula One mindset in racing that was for people that were really putting themselves on the forefront of performance. And then there was the general consumer. And the general consumer probably wasn't even interested in the kind of things that they can be interested in today. And much more than that, the manufacturer, the person creating things, wouldn't be offering it. But now you have the unleashing of everything that is conceived being available. And the guinea pigs are everybody. And back to my guinea pig analogy, before I sold bikes to people, I raced my innovations, my ideas. I was breaking things. I was crashing. I was thankfully coming back and still surviving my mistakes, but I was learning. I was going through my education process under the wing of my parents in my parents' garage before I was doing it in the public arena, and people were watching it. They were aware that I had problems. They were also aware that I beat them if I didn't have a problem, and so there was a transition from a European-driven sport. And one of the things that you might have heard me say in the Farstall interview is there was this transition in the era of the beginning of the mountain bike and Greg LeMond and some Americans racing abroad. There was a transition of a European-dominated sport to a highly experimental and technology culture, so to speak, in Silicon Valley, and myself and a few others that created what we now have. And that I lived through that transition. I saw it. I saw the synapses firing. I saw the challenges being thrown down. I saw the ideas coming and going and being stomped on and being vitalized. And it was the beginning of experimenting with titanium and carbon fiber and materials that had been nothing. I mean, Pino Moroni was the first one that I knew that made a titanium stem for Eddie Merckx doing his hour record in Mexico City. And so, I mean, there were these little players in America that were doing things. And I was on the West Coast, and I was in my little community and racing, and there were other people in other places, but it was still such a small community that was doing it. And for the most part, it was delegated to the racer. It was not for public consumption. It was not, we didn't care. I didn't care about really a business side of what I was doing until I was probably making a decision as an 18-year-old, a 17-year-old in what I wanted to pursue. But things were changing, and the mountain bike was caught up in that. And the thing that most people don't realize is Greg LeMond probably had more to do with why the mountain bike was considered to be innovative than anyone would ever imagine.
On that note, can you hold on a second? We need to take a real quick break. I want to hear more about Greg LeMond's sort of influence there. Hang on one second. So we're talking with Tom Ritchie. We are going to take a real quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to keep going with this conversation. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Okay, we're back. If you are just joining me, I've been talking with Tom Ritchie. It's a really fascinating conversation. We ended the first part talking about how Greg LeMond actually had an influence on mountain biking. So pick it up from there.
Well, I would say having someone like LeMond with his amazing junior world result and opportunities to go abroad and race with the legends of Europe and do it with his brash, strong personality and creating conditions for his racing that had to do with his contract. His contract was famous for basically, you know, not letting an established sport like cycling basically dictate the terms. And from what I wasn't there. I just have heard stories about it. He just basically put it down and said, you know, this is how I'm going to race. And if you can accept that, I'll race. And it's anyway, dictated terms that had never been dictated in the past. So for the most part, you were told this is what you have to do. And this is the bike you have to ride and all this kind of things. And Greg flipped that. And as a result of flipping that and a result of the results that he had, the eyes of the world, the cycling world, were upon him, and he delivered. And as a result of that, those same eyes were looking at the United States. They were looking at things that were coming from what Greg was insisting upon and the innovations that were part of what was at the time the mountain bike and the experimenting that I was doing with a few others in the mountain bike were part of the eyes of the world. And I know at the time that people that I was building bikes for and racing against were telling me, what are you doing? What are you wasting your time on these off-road bikes? You've got a great career going. You've got people that are at the top of it that are winning on your product, and what are you wasting all that on this off-road bike? And I think for me, the indicator that it was valuable use of my time, of course, was I was enjoying it, and I was part of riding that way anyway, and I was just enjoying it more and more. But the thing that was happening simultaneous to that is when you receive an order from Antonio Columbus and an order from Ugo De Rosa and an order from Unzo Shimano, and you've never had an international order in your life, you can pay attention to it.
Yeah, no kidding. You think?
Yeah. And so, you know, it went from, you know, we buy things from them to they buy things from me. And I immediately realized that something was going on that was bigger than me and bigger than anything I'd done. And what seemed to be a changing in people's attitudes and kind of, I would say, you know, somewhat of a cultural awareness that was happening around the going off road. It was, I think you probably remember the bike centennial in 1976.
Sure, absolutely.
And how big of a deal that was, and how people got into cycling, and then the bike industry was kind of in a lull. They were dragging, and people were unhappy with what was going on. There was very little what you would consider to be excitement or enthusiasm in the cycling world. And the mountain bike came along, and all of a sudden you had people like Jerry Garcia and other people that were, you know, basically lazy musicians and people of fame that were riding this crazy bike and raving about it.
Right.
So you had a lot of things that were coming kind of into a convergence at the same time. And I was, you know, me and a few others were in the middle of it. And I was very, very blessed to have the skills at that time to do something with it. And I had already gone through, as I said, my education of experimenting. And so by then I was pretty confident with what I could do and my design and production abilities and fabrication abilities and stuff. And I'd already established fillet braze construction. Practically everything I made was fillet braze without lugs, and which was kind of unusual for anyone else in the industry. And so I didn't require lugs. I didn't require tubing diameters. I could basically take something and join two tubes together in a very sound and solid way, in a beautiful way. And people were confident because they saw a history of me building for, you know, 8 years, 1,000 bikes, and a certain track record. And they liked the idea of being able to trust that, I think. And this was before TIG welding. It wasn't before TIG welding, but it was before TIG welding was applied to a road bike in the bike industry. So it was applied to BMX and things like that. But that was kind of it was very understood and evaluated in terms of the serious cyclists, as you probably know.
Yeah, which brings me to the question of steel and its efficacy going forward. I mean, we're still big proponents of steel. I think many of my listeners are from the era of steel, still own steel bikes, still ride steel bikes, and yet we seem to be living in a carbon fiber world. So do you think there will be a resurgence of metal bikes sometime? There's a lot of pushback with the problems of carbon fiber in the environment, for example?
Again, a very loaded, big topic.
Of course.
I would say that we are probably on steel 2.0 right now, around the turn of the century. I probably had $100,000 worth of steel tubing and forks that all got scrapped and thrown in a dumpster because there was nothing to do with it. It was inventory that had no value.
That's kind of scary, Tom.
I saved the best of it, but it was scary. There was absolutely no business. There was no interest in it. There was no business. So, you know, with the hand-built bike show and kind of that period, the period of time starting maybe 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I think I'm fuzzy on the exact date.
Yeah, he's about 15, I think, this year in Sacramento coming up.
Yeah. So I think with the advent of that and kind of the art crowd of getting into frame building, there was a lot that has happened with them and steel. And I'm very excited to have my steel bikes going again and all that. But, you know, I think that what you might have heard me in that interview talk about was really the marketing side of carbon and aluminum, and how steel is, you know, unless you create signage that's weightless, you're not going to ever bring steel in terms of a material to the point that people are going to be promoting it. And, you know, with a down tube that's two or three times the size of anything you can create on a steel bike, companies love their brands big.
That's true. That is what you said. I do remember you saying that it was the real estate for the logos that makes this carbon fiber so attractive to the manufacturer.
Well, it started out with aluminum. That was
true.
That was the beginning point in the 80s with Cannondale.
Right.
And the industry overnight realized how successful Cannondale was and immediately said me too and had to have that. And that was the death of steel. But it was more complicated than that because at that time, the mountain bike side was an aluminum, was aluminum focused. And that was primarily because with the advent of suspension and people trying to create suspension linkages, aluminum was really the only viable lightweight way of making it happen. And so when you're loading up a bike with suspension, it just made sense to do it in aluminum. And when you're taking the edge off of bumps and you have a spring mechanism and shocks and things and linkages and stuff, it really was behaving quite differently than a road bike in terms of what it was doing in a passive way. So it made sense. And then you had the confusion of the materials. You had people really not understanding the differences in materials. They didn't understand that aluminum was lighter, but it was also much different in terms of its modulus elasticity, its fatigue life. And the thing that shot out of that in the final kind of years is that carbon solved that. Carbon created an infinite modulus characteristic depending upon what you were trying to accomplish, and the heyday of carbon fiber came along. And what you know, the beginners in carbon that Greg started out with were making carbon based on very similar tubing diameters to steel.
You mean like Calfee stuff?
Yeah. And those diameters were amazing. They created all kinds of wonderful ride characteristics, similar to smaller titanium tube bikes. But then again, weight started to become the most important factor. Monocoque construction was very important. And then you got the confusion with the triathlon aerodynamic community and the ride quality community. And that's where I could talk for hours about that. Basically, aerodynamics has gotten into the marketing side of every company. And what happens with shapes and profiles and then the new regulations and wheels and all that kind of stuff started to change. And branding became an important thing, wheels and all kinds of things. And so big shapes and aerodynamics helped go a direction that we're in right now. And at this point, we're lost in terms of the true value and probably ever to get it back of ride quality.
What about cost too? I mean, we're talking about bikes that are so expensive today.
Yeah, just like with aluminum, people didn't understand that Cannondale was making a cheaper frame when it was aluminum. People don't understand that they're actually making a cheaper and cheaper carbon frame. And it's really not a cost. I would say at a high-end racing bike, it's not a cost thing as much as it is what a company wants to do. You know, what they feel is, in a dog-eat-dog world of business, what they need to do to stay in business.
It all looks like me too, though. There's so much of it that just, it all looks the same to me.
Yeah. Well, it is driven by, you know, that, yeah, need to follow a look. And basically, we entered the fashion side of the business probably about the time Sella Italia developed the Flight Saddle, which goes back to the 90s.
Right.
And people started touching the bike in a different way, and the Italians became the fashion designers of the industry, and it resulted in, a lot of things that have to do with feel and shape and aerodynamics, and that got mixed into it. And so steel will never be sexy like those things. The best thing someone can do on a good steel bike is to do a really nice paint job. And of course, good paint covers all kinds of things. You can have a TIG welded, relatively common looking way of joining a bike and have a nice paint job, and it completely, kind of makes it go away. So lug work and the craft and all these kind of things that were my beginnings are valued differently in today's modern world. And back to your question or your statement about, what happens in the recycling way of a carbon bike, it's something that is, I think, a lot more complicated than just the recycling. You know, the life cycle of a product. When I'm of a generation, and it sounds like you are too, that you don't like to waste things.
No.
There's just an elegance and a value to not consuming everything to the point that you throw it away.
Getting things that last a long time. That it's what you like. It's what you love. It's what I've been riding. I can't find anything wrong with it. It isn't broken. I'll put a new chain and cassette on it, and I don't want another bike.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of opposites going on in the industry right now. We have an industry that is now kind of rediscovering the steel bike, but rediscovering it through what is called the adventure bike or the gravel bike.
Right.
And that is a good thing. It is, you know, an interesting way that the industry has responded to what I would say is the kind of, you know, coming back on itself. The value of looking at a bike in a utility sense is a very, very important thing. And to me, that you can do anything with a bike. You choose one bike and you ride it in any way you want and have the freedom to do anything you want with it is a good thing. The disconnect that I have with that is that it's done at an expense or at a level that most people are happy with a bike that lasts a couple of years. And manufacturers kind of don't talk about lifetime when it comes to building, you know, the lightest bike. They really want to shy away from that. If they're not beaten up in the marketplace for having bikes that last a couple of years, then they're not going to change their ways.
Right.
They're not going to make more robust bikes. They're going to still compete for being able to say they have the lightest this, lightest that.
And can continue to sell more bikes to the same people.
It's more and more limited. I would say if you're talking high end, what I'm seeing is that I'm seeing, you know, less and less sales. And it's just people, once they've got a bike they like, they're keeping it. The thing that I was going to say is that with steel, and kind of coming full circle from where we started the conversation, I had a used bike. It started out with a used bike. And it started out with practically everyone I know with a used steel bike that had been recycled. And the uniqueness about steel is it lasts a long time. And it bends. And it bends back. And it's repairable. And if you understand that was a design feature thought through from the very beginning 100 years ago, and you look at where we are right now, it's not understood. Because right now we have a global marketplace. We have testing standards that say it cannot break. It cannot break is different than it cannot bend. It's a whole different nuance that's put upon the bike industry. And a breaking steel bike is not very common. A bending steel bike, I would say it's relatively normal. A breaking aluminum bike is common. When a carbon bike breaks, it's disastrous. And so what you have is you have an industry that's perverted all its testing standards in a direction of it cannot break because it's catastrophic. And all the lawsuits and all the things that have to do with people's fear of death and all those things are part of that testing standard. So I think you probably heard me talk about the one-inch steel fork. It's never coming back.
Right.
It's never coming back on any global company because it can't. It won't come back. Everything has been skewed to a carbon fork not breaking. And if you have a carbon fork that doesn't break, you have a carbon fork that is not resilient. It doesn't absorb energy. Back when I was building a lot of steel bikes, I told people, you want your fork to bend. If I design this bike right and you get into a head-on crash, your fork is going to bend and release energy, and save your frame.
Right.
Your frame is much more valuable than your fork.
Right.
And so people understood that. And so occasionally I'd have to replace a fork, but frame usually was fine. That's not going to happen anymore unless you take an old bike that's 30 years old, which fortunately there's a lot of old 30-year-old bikes that are good bikes.
Yeah, they're out there. They are out there all the time. What do you think about overcoming some of the resistance about people riding on the roads? I mean, we're seeing a decrease in ridership. This is a little more philosophical and less technical, but there aren't paths everywhere. Bike paths, you can't go fast. So what do you think we can do? I mean, that's also hurting bike shops. It's hurting the industry that people are actually riding less.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it doesn't hinder me. I guess I've learned to grow a third eyeball out the back of my head or something. But I understand, you know, if you have choice and you have a bike and you have trails and you have ways of riding differently, it's probably a lot to do with, you know, the idea, the concept of gravel riding is an important thing to people. Is it mountain bikes? Yeah, it's a little bit sketchy to probably ride technically the way that it's being promoted these days with enduro riding and all that kind of stuff. I think the idea of maybe riding, you know, something that's like a gravel bike is a fanciful way of kind of taking the negative side of mountain bikes and the negative side of riding on the road and blend it into something that's more attractive to people. But I'd, you know, have to agree with you. The roads in California are worse than they were when I was 15 years old.
You mean in terms of the surface of the road or the amount of traffic or both?
I wasn't even talking about traffic.
Okay.
I was talking about shoulders, right. Maintenance, culverts, Caltrans doing repairs. I've never seen it as bad as I've seen it now. There's a public work side of repairing and maintaining roads that's horrible.
So infrastructure.
And it's like you can go back and you can look at the shoulders and where lines are painted and the growth that comes out. And you cannot ride on what would be considered to be any kind of a shoulder these days. They don't even pave the shoulder. They don't even try to give you a shoulder. They don't even maintain the shoulder. They don't even maintain the growth on the shoulder. You're riding in the lane and you're riding around potholes and things that were once filled and repaired and stuff. So you are in a much more dangerous situation with traffic than you've ever been riding on the road. And it's, you know, we're living in the heyday of cycling. We're living when cycling is king and more people are riding. And that's so that you're riding on a peaceful road or a peaceful dirt road or a more peaceful route or whatever it is a big deal. I can only appreciate that when it comes to where I seek to ride and where I've lived and places I find interesting. We just got back from New Zealand, 2 weeks in New Zealand, and riding the tandem every day. And I loved it. 4.5 million people in a place that's much bigger than California with so much coastline and so many dirt roads and stuff. It's phenomenal.
It's a bad comparison to try to make. It's like you don't want to make that comparison. So are you going to, you just answered one of my questions. Are you going to be doing more traveling this year?
I'll be in Switzerland, Germany, Italy, and the trade shows around Interbike. And I always, you know, basically I travel with my wife and Martha in our tandem. And that's the way that we enjoy riding these days. So basically having a tandem that goes into a breakaway case or two breakaway cases has been a wonderful thing for us. And it's been all over the world. It's been in Africa and all over the place. So doesn't really, you know, if I've got, you know, kind of nerves of steel, which you trust when it comes to conditions, cars and traffic doesn't bother me. And if it doesn't bother me, it seems to be okay with her. It just seems to be a part of living now.
Yeah. Well, a good captain, you know, it makes all the difference. So you're the consummate innovator. You working on anything new right now that you can talk about? Obviously, we don't want trade secrets here.
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, everyone's working on something new. It's if you start out being creative, you're always kind of, I think that's one of the unique things about humans, is that that's what it, being creative is. It's figuring out new things. I would say the things that I'm interested in have to do with travel and making travel easier, making it more enjoyable, safer. I've got new bags that I'm working on that have never been done before.
For your breakaways?
It doesn't matter. Breakaway, okay. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's you know, kind of something I've been working on for years, and I want to bring to market something that makes it easier for people to put things on their bike and not on their back. And then just on, you know, continued evolution of steel and better steel bikes and lighter steel bikes. And there's always, you know, ways to form and cast and press. And, you know, I understand fabrication probably better than the next guy. I feel capable in that way. Yeah.
All right. Well, I always ask my guests three questions. These are the hard ones. What's your favorite food?
Anything Martha makes. I would say particularly Mexican food. So, but anyway, I'm Californian.
That's true. What kind of music do you listen to?
Van Morrison a lot. And,
cool.
Jazz and Jackson Browne.
Cool. And do you and Martha have any pets?
Well, we have an overweight cat that is waiting for us right now and bored to death. And a hamster that she got for Christmas.
Nice. Don't get a second one. They're cannibals. All right. Well, geez, this has just been great. I mean, I have probably 100 more questions. It would take another 100 more hours, and I would love to talk again. So maybe I can put you on a rain check for another conversation at some point.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks. It was nice to meet you, Diane.
You too. And maybe we'll catch up actually in person someday.
All right.
Thanks.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
It is such an honor and a privilege to be able to talk with some of the interesting, influential, and forward-thinking people in our industry, and Tom Ritchie is certainly one of them. I hope you enjoyed this encore presentation. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with a brand new show. And in the meantime, I hope you are safe and warm. Stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.